Welcome to the Chrisman Commentary Daily Mortgage News Podcast. I'm your host, Robbie Chrisman. Topics on today's episode include the new HMDA data, segments from yesterday's Mortgages with Millennials show featuring Nesmith's Niles Lichtenstein and Built Rewards' Jonathan Lawless discussing co-buying, and mortgage applications continue their downward trend. Thanks to today's podcast sponsor, Stabby. Stabby's loss mitigation solution offers a top-tier experience for homeowners and servicers, streamlining processes into a secure, customer-centric platform. It ensures transparency and real-time access to data, documents, and eligibility decisions for all stakeholders. Stabby's system ensures compliance, expedites decision-making, and provides servicers with flexibility to adapt to evolving business conditions. This enhances pull-through rates and enables better management of variable costs, ultimately optimizing the loss mitigation process. The Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, or HMDA, Modified Loan Application Register data for 2023, is now available on the Federal Financial Institutions Examination Council's HMDA platform for approximately 5,089 HMDA filers. The published data contains loan-level information filed by financial institutions and modified to protect consumer privacy. To increase public availability, the annual loan-level LAR data for each HMDA filer are now available online. Previously, users could obtain LAR data only by making requests to specific institutions for their annual data. To allow for easier public access to all LAR data, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's 2015 HMDA rule made the data for each HMDA filer available electronically on the FFIEC's HMDA platform. In addition to institution-specific modified LAR files, users can download one combined file that contains all institutions' modified LAR data. And later this year, the 2023 HMDA data will be available in other forms to provide users insights into the data. These will include nationwide loan-level datasets with all publicly available data for all HMDA reporters, aggregate and disclosure reports with summary information by geography and lender, and access to the 2023 data through the HMDA data browser to allow users to create custom datasets, reports, and data maps. The CFPB will later also publish a data point article highlighting key trends in the annual data. For today's interview, I wanted to share with you some excerpts from yesterday's Mortgages with Millennials show that I host alongside Kristen Messerly, which featured Nesmith's Niles Lichtenstein and Built Rewards' Jonathan Lawless discussing co-buying.
Okay, I'm so excited about this episode. We cannot be talking about mortgages with millennials without talking about co-buying and home sharing models. So I can't think of two people that would be better fit for this conversation other than John and Niles. And I myself have purchased a tenancy in common, which is a type of co-buying kind of model. And so it's something I'm really passionate about and helping make homeownership more affordable and also accessible to millennials. So let's start with just having each of you talk about, you know, your role in that space and what your companies do around that as well. Niles, let's start with you.
Sure. Hey, thank you all for having me. I've been really excited about this conversation. Huge fan of what you all are doing, Kristen and Robbie. Nesmint, we help millennial and Gen Z buyers pool their capital together and make real estate a reality. We do that and focused on kind of three different types of co-buying. The first is what we call a term that we're coining called shift. So second home is the first time buying, right? So we have a lot of folks who may not be able to afford where they work and live, that there's quite a few folks or don't know exactly where they're going to live and they're young and they want to start off and they want to start with a investment property to start to build equity and not miss out on that period of time. So their second home becomes their first home. So they pull their capital and purchase a long-term rental property or a short-term rental property that they can visit and enjoy the benefits of having. Our second group is what we call primary multi-unit. So the ability to be able to live in the place where you may work and want to reside, but also be able to afford it through buying a 2-4 unit building, right? So you have the opportunity to to live in one and or multiple. We have, you know, groups of three or four couples, families going in together, which is kind of cool. And then the last is around parent and child and helping, you know, people, multi-generational groups get together and help them share. And really, you know, this is not anything new we're bringing to, frankly, you know, these are, old traditions actually in a lot of cultures, but we're just trying to create an easier path forward for it.
So, you know, my background has been in housing. I spent 20 great years at Fannie Mae with some amazing people, ran product there for a while and have always been really fascinated about housing innovation, which is why I've been really drawn to this space and drawn to Built in general. Let's say a few words about Built just so you kind of know what we do. So Built, we have an audience of renters and our motto is that we make paying rent rewarding. We want renters to get something back for paying rent. We want it also to be a stepping stone to getting into home ownership. And so the way to think about our company is I often use the analogy of your airline. So if you fly Delta, when you take a flight, you get Delta Sky Miles. Sort of the same analogy applies to us, except the version of flights for us is you live in one of our properties, and we've partnered with about 80 of the largest multifamily operators out there. So that represents about 4 million units across the United States. And if you live in one of these properties, you're actually making your rental payment through our technology, and we give you points every time you make your rent payment on time. And not only that, but we also offer you the ability to furnish your rental data to the credit bureau. So your rent is also improving your credit score. So it's as simple as that. You pay rent, you earn rewards, but we've also made it possible to earn a lot more rewards. So we've built this new program. We call it our Neighborhood Rewards Program, where renters in their local area can go to grocery stores, to restaurants, they can use Lyft or gas stations, pharmacies, and these local places in the neighborhood, instead of trying to create their own bespoke loyalty program or give a discount, they basically are giving away Built points. And so you can go shopping in your neighborhood. Now, not only are you earning points and rent, but you're also earning it in your local neighborhood as well. And then the last thing I'll mention, just like if you're flying Delta, you can also get a Delta Amex. So for our prime renters, they can apply for our Built MasterCard. It has no annual fee and there's no transaction cost when you use it to pay rent, which any other credit card, you're going to pay a huge fee to use your credit card. For us, there's no transaction cost and you get a point for every dollar on rent you spend. And that's not limited to people that live in our properties. Any renter anywhere can get the Built MasterCard and earn points on their rent. So if you or anybody knows a renter, especially in some of these high cost markets, they absolutely should be getting the Built MasterCard to earn all those rewards. So all of this matters because our points are really significant now. We now have the most valuable point in the entire loyalty ecosystem, which is really quite an impressive accomplishment for such a young company to sort of outpace the likes of Amex and Chase Sapphire. So you can use our points for things like travel. We're one-on-one relationships with almost every airline, hotel. You can use it directly on Amazon. And what gets really exciting is our points are also available to use towards a down payment on a home. So anyway, so that kind of builds out the full model. Lots of ways to earn points on the platform. You're building your credit, you're building your down payment. And ultimately what we're trying to do is help renters get into home ownership, which, as you know, is really hard now, which is why we've been sort of looking for alternative ways to sort of provide advice to our renters on finding ways into home ownership. And Nessman has been, you know, an incredible partner in this. We sent a lot of Built members to Nessman who have successfully now entered into home ownership by co-buying with somebody else. So we surveyed our renters and we were shocked at the number who considered co-buying, considered buying their second home first. I mean, over 60% on both of those questions. So we knew there'd be a real market for, you know, the things like Nessman is offering.
Help us introduce to the audience what co-ownership looks like and why that's important to, or co-buying looks like and why that's important to affordability for millennials and kind of introducing that topic.
There's a wide variety, right? It's a, and maybe both of us took a moment because there's a spectrum of co-buying in terms of how you're thinking about that. There's ways to potentially co-buy with corporate partners. There's ways in institutional capital. There's ways to co-buy with certain programs. So all of those are opportunities that I think people should look at, because, you know, obviously we know that the disparity between wage growth and the appreciation on homes is huge. My focus is really on this notion of kind of pooling capital with other individuals, right? Whether they're family or friends or people that you know, or in some cases we're even matchmaking, which is the event that Jonathan and I are at. Actually, a couple matches came out of that, which was really, really interesting. Someone was like, you should be the Tinder of co-buying. But it kind of, the way that we look at co-buying is it's structured in a few different ways. One is in enabling a group to first get aligned, right? So having alignment. You may have already had this conversation with a family or friend before over a bottle of wine, right? Hey, let's get this place together. Or, oh, we travel to these same places all the time. Or I'm tired of paying rent, and we're ready to be homeowners. So all of those conversations happen. Some people don't even know it's an opportunity, but when you get those folks aligned, you start to allow them to one, we have a whole bunch of data on the platform, and that's really important to look at. You know, if you're going to buy an investment property, where are you buying that property? Understanding the forward-looking appreciation, understanding the rents in those markets. And then obviously, if you're looking in the place that you're living and you're going to be sharing a primary, just thinking through and understanding what are the things that check off the boxes, right? If anyone's watched Indian Matchmaker, you get 7 out of 10. Right? That's kind of how they, and we have a whole bunch of, and I know we're going to be working with First Home IQ on a whole bunch of education around what are some of the alignment elements. So alignment, financial projections. I used to have to build out a whole, we can go into my background at some point, because I've been co-buying for the past 10 years to help make the Bay Area affordable for family and friends and co-buying. And I think I might've been the first house hacker at the age of 13 when my mom, as a single mom, had to find a way to keep our home in the Bay Area. We rented it out to UC Berkeley grad students. I've been around it in some ways of these non-traditional pathways, but after projection around financials, then, you know, what's been really important, and Jonathan and I have worked closely on this, is finding the right lenders, right? Finding the right mortgage providers who can understand the situation, who understand co-buying. Typically, you can have 4 co-borrowers on a loan application. There's ways we're looking at extending that too. But being able to bring those folks together, understanding what your budget is, and then we're working with the agent and so forth on finding that specific home, and we help them through that process. In some cases, also building out the entity, and in all cases, building out the operating agreement. So just so everyone is on the same page. And that's what Nessman does. We try to make sure that we have a human touch from beginning to end, but, you know, enabled throughout that process in terms of the technology. We feel that people have been talking about this so often. We're doing a primary multifamily workshop. We try to do some hyper local ones, and I'll tell some stories in just a sec of different folks. But we're doing one in the Bay Area, and this you know, just recently, this last week, we closed on a quadplex, a 4 unit. There was 2 wonderful engineers, Black engineers, and they said to me, like, okay, we were told we'd go to the best college, you go to a good college, you get a good job, and you can finally afford. And it's 15 years later, and I still can't afford, right? They went to UC Berkeley, one became a mechanical engineer, the other became a computer scientist. And so what was really amazing last week is to walk with them. Because I'm local here, walk to them to their quadplex and see that they were finally able, they're going to move in with their partners into 2 units and then rent out 2 units. So those are the stories that I think are really exciting for us when we think about kind of co-buying and what that means.
Yeah. And I'll just to add another dimension to that. I mean, if you take a step back, I mean, traditionally homes are purchased by somebody has equity, their down payment, and then they go get debt and finance the rest of the mortgage. But what we've seen with sort of this really tight supply in the market is that you're just now competing with people that just have way more means. And we heard the SHIFT acronym. I'll throw out another acronym. There's sort of the DINKs, the dual income, no kids, or the people who are married and thinking about having a kid soon, or, you know, the millennial generation is now kind of moving into that mating and procreating period of life. And you have all these dual income households that are able to afford a lot more because they have 2 sources of income. So if you're a single household or single head of household or the single earner in the household, just way more challenging to compete in this sort of supply starved industry. So what do we do? Well, the idea is like try to divide up ownership of the home to make it more affordable. And co-buying is in my mind, a very practical and I think a very lifestyle familiar one for a lot of people. Many of us have roommates when we grow up, right? A lot of, you know, a lot of different cultures like sort of support multi-generational housing. That's very common. And so this idea of co-buying with people that you know makes a ton of sense. But, you know, we've just seen a sort of proliferation of models that have basically said, you don't have to be the only person that's putting equity into this home. You could have another entity that sort of becomes a co-investor with you. And there's just a lot of really interesting models. And what that does is enable somebody who doesn't have the means today to compete in this absurd market to be able to compete and actually get into home ownership earlier than they otherwise would be.
Yeah, I just was having a conversation with the folks at Freddie, and I saw the stat that not only is the, you know, the typically we were like 1.6 million in terms of lack of supply, but if you take the folks that I think FHFA just talked about, if you take the folks that are locked in because they're at such a low interest rate, which I don't think we'll get back to that low interest rate again, that there's another 1.2 million, right? So now we're getting close to 3 million in this gap. So even if rates go down a little bit in demand, you're not going to see housing prices really retreat, at least in my mind, in the near term, right? So at some point there might be an interesting supply shift, right, with generationally, but right now and over the next 10 years, I think you're going to continue to run into that. So finding demand side solutions is, you know, to what Jonathan's talking about is what we're really thinking about here. The other thing that I think is so important psychologically, this is what's interesting about the shift model. You know, I take an example that we have on the site with Selena and Wade. They're older millennials, professionals in Brooklyn. They've been looking to buy for a while. They finally said, let me just buy a place up in Hudson Valley that they can get away to that feels like a home, but they can also rent and offset. And why I said feels like a home and the psychology of it, there's something really important about feeling that sense of ownership and that we're finding. And, you know, B of A comes out with their study, like every 3-4 years, and home ownership always beat kids and marriage. And this was interesting that it's the first time that it actually beat career fulfillment. Like people wanted home ownership more than career fulfillment, kids and marriage, right? And that was really interesting and surprising, but also very understandable.
Do you recommend a buy-sell agreement between co-buyers?
Yeah, we have a number of different types of agreements that we basically spent the last couple of years collecting templated types of agreements for different situations, and so we have a few, a number of them have different, and we can and. Feel free to reach out to me, Niles at Nesmith. We can go deeper into this, but a number of them have unique opportunities of how you sell in terms of giving first right of refusal to other owners, having a time period where you can share it to privately to family and friends. We're actually on the Nesmith platform enabling you to do this more privately and also potentially putting it on a public exchange to allow for some level of liquidity. And then there's also a certain set of hangman clauses that say, hey, if we can't reach certain agreements, we all sell it. Or if the property has appreciated by a certain amount, we just sell it at that point. So there are some nuances there that are interesting. On the investment side too, what we've worked on with lenders, and a lot of folks don't know that you can do this with qualified mortgages, is actually transfer into an LLC. So in a number of cases, there's some tax benefits with that as well, but transferring into an LLC then allows for a little bit more movement in terms of, you know, even things like the ownership and equity percentages to be more dynamic, right? Roof caves in, not everyone can afford at that point. And things like that. So, but yeah, reach out to me in the chat or Niles at Nesmith, and we can go deeper.
Are there common misconceptions that you think are worth addressing today? Or it's kind of like this, you know, it's too good to be true. You know, kind of take us through, peel back the curtain a little bit for us.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I know, Jonathan, you've seen all different types of forms of this. I think the one that comes out, you probably read lots of articles about this, is it's just obviously people don't like this notion of mixing money with friends and family, right? So so what we've tried to really enable is coming at it from the perspective of Hey, things are going to happen. How do we become a third party that takes the emotion out of it, right? How do we become a platform that, you know, I know what it's like very personally. I bought my first triplex with cousins, right? Like, we know, you know, that situation, like, and what's amazing is over, they just thought they'd never be able to afford the Bay Area. And I had a little capital from a previous startup and put that down. And next thing you know, like 9 years later, we refinance and now they have checks to buy their primary. And that's what we're kind of hoping for. They weren't born with stock portfolios or anything else in that case. So, but yes, I think, you know, the friends and family issues can always come up. We've hired an advisor who actually works on family mediation and friend mediation to help us understand what are the things, but being a third party can help with that. Having very clear lines of delineation, best practices, like we make sure that each of our groups put 3 to 6 months in a joint account that almost never gets touched, right? Because the last thing you want is a pandemic or someone losing their job and that creating fear. And then there's the focus. We're realigning our focus. And this is, for me, something that's been really important, which has been around how do we build community, right? It's not just about, there's a financial necessity that's pushing us this way, but also in a world where we're feeling constantly isolated. Like I own a building here, it kind of is a nestment. We own it with another couple. We've actually been thinking about buying a fourplex with four of us because we each have two kids, and two working families with two kids is really tough, right? So we came up with our plan that, you know, one weekend out of the week, the other couples take the two kids and we go off, right? For just like some reconnection time. I only bring that up because there's actually these notions of rethinking not only how we can financially afford, but also, you know, how we can kind of live together in this interesting way. But yeah, there are those things. There's also other too good to be true. When you put something into an LLC, right? For instance, if you're going to refinance it, you have to put it back into the names. There are still some things that I think we're actively working out to make a lot of that process a little bit more streamlined. So there are things at the margins and the nuances. But overall, frankly, you know, at least you can talk to the folks who've gone through Nessman. It's been the difference between owning or not. So.
Yeah, I'll add one experience that we had at Fannie Mae when we developed the Home Ready product. When we first launched the product, we had a feature that basically allowed a residing a person that was living in the house who made significant income, who was not on the mortgage, would be able to sort of document that they were actually making income to help the person qualify. And so again, this is a very typical thing. We see multi-generational households where you have multiple income earners. And the idea was, well, let's help the person qualify. There are other people living in the house and contributing to household expenses. And what we were really surprised about, and I think this is really important for those in the lending community that are listening, was that nobody used it. And maybe one reason typical of anything that the GSEs do, there are a lot of shitty complexity in terms of how it got rolled out. But actually, the thing that we found was more of an issue is that when we talk to people, this idea of somebody else being a part of the home on the mortgage in some way created issues on both sides. On the side of the homeowner, it was like, whoa, I want this to be mine. This is my home. I don't want anybody else to be included in this. And then the other side is like, wait, am I on this mortgage? And like, there's a lot of confusion there between the two parties. And a lot of that was just cultural. It was sort of the pride of having your own home. I think one thing that really needs to be overcome is this idea that co-buying is somehow lesser than, right? It's a negative thing that you're doing because you can't afford it by yourself. And the reality is, you know, to Niles's point, like, homes are so expensive right now, it shouldn't be viewed as lesser than. So getting people comfortable with the arrangement that it is a meaningful way to get into home ownership early, to actually have the benefits of the wealth creation of home ownership, it's really important. So anyway, I think there is a lot to overcome with regards to that sort of relationship, but I think we'll see that slowly start to change as the perception changes of, you know, what it takes to really own a home these days.
With Friday's PCE deflator data release being the focal point of this week, even as it comes on a day that markets are closed for the Good Friday holiday, things have gotten off to a quiet start. We learned yesterday that home prices fell 0.1% in January, the first decrease since August 2022, according to the FHFA House Price Index. On a year-over-year basis, home prices rose 6.3%, on track with the historical average and a data point which was echoed by the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. Home price increases are likely to moderate, as Americans gradually get used to higher rates and more existing listings come to market. And home sales are expected to pick up on a percentage basis amid strengthening turnover seasonals as the traditional spring home buying season gets underway. Yesterday came news that durable goods orders rose 1.4% in February, slightly better than expected after falling a revised 6.9% in January. The key takeaway from the report is that business spending rebounded after a poor January as non-defense capital goods orders increased 4.4%. Today's economic calendar kicked off with mortgage applications decreasing 0.7% from 1 week earlier, according to data from the Mortgage Bankers Association's weekly mortgage application survey. Later today brings remarks from Fed Governor Waller and Treasury auctioned $60 billion of four-month bills, $28 billion of reopened two-year FRNs, and $43 billion of seven-year notes. Recall that yesterday witnessed a strong $67 billion five-year note auction, which followed Monday's weak two-year note sale. We begin the day with agency MBS prices roughly unchanged from late Tuesday and all week, and the 10-year yielding 4.22 after closing yesterday at 4.23%. The 2 years at 4.58. Let's wrap up with a joke and some housekeeping. The other day, my wife asked me to pass her lipstick, but I accidentally passed her a glue stick. She still isn't talking to me. Thanks again to today's podcast sponsor, Stabby. Stabby offers a flexible and fully customizable loss mitigation solution. Servicers can easily adapt to regulatory updates and market conditions, providing a seamless, customer-centric digital experience. Stabby transforms a potentially stressful time for customers into a streamlined, secure process. If you have any questions about the podcast or sponsoring opportunities, send me an email at robbie@robchrisman.com. Visit robchrisman.com for more information on our industry partners, access to archived commentaries, and how to subscribe to the daily mortgage news and commentary. To listen to or download past episodes of this podcast, search Mortgage News on any platform you get your podcast from.